dial number and added, "Or call Ms. Mayfield." I gave her Kate's number, which she read to me from her telephone. I hung up. In the event we weren't in, our voicemail would just say Corey Task Force or Mayfield Task Force, followed by a pleasant request to leave a name and number. That was vague enough and didn't use the upsetting word terrorist. So putting this unlikely lead out of my mind, I again began my incident report, which was a bit overdue. Assuming no one would ever read this, I thought I could get away with 4 pages, numbered 1 to 50, with blank pages in between. In fact, I decided to start at the end and typed, so in conclusion. Kate's phone rang, and it was Jack Koenig. After a few seconds, she said, "Pick up." I hit the button for Kate's line and said, "Corey." Mr. Koenig was in a cheery mood and said, "You're pissing me off." "Yes, sir." Kate held the phone away from her ear in a theatrical gesture. Koenig continued, "You disobey an order to fly to Frankfurt, you don't return phone calls, and you were missing in action last night." "Yes, sir." "Where were you? You're supposed to stay in contact." "Yes, sir." "Well, where were you?" I have a really funny line for this question when I used to get asked it by one of my former bosses. I would say, "My date was arrested for prostitution, and I spent the night in court posting bail." But as I say, these people lacked a sophisticated sense of humor, so I replied to Jack, "I have no excuse, sir." Kate cut in and said, "I called the ICC and told the duty officer that Mr. Corey and I were in my apartment until further notice. I gave no further notice, and we were here by 8:45 a.m. Silence. Then Jack said, "I see." He cleared his throat and informed us, "I'll be flying back to New York and should arrive in the office by 8 p.m. New York time. Please be there, if it's not inconvenient." We assured him it was no inconvenience. I took the opportunity to ask him, "Can you expedite Kate's request for the deleted information in the personnel file of Colonel Hambrecht?" Again, silence. Then he said, "The Department of Defense has informed us that the information is not pertinent to his murder and therefore not pertinent to this case." "What is it pertinent to?" I asked. Koenig replied, "Hambrecht had nuclear clearance. The deleted information pertains to that. It's standard operating procedure to delete nuclear stuff from a personnel file." He added, "Don't waste time on this." "Okay." In fact, I knew this to be true from another case I had years ago that involved an Air Force officer. Jack went on to other subjects, talking about the Perth Amboy murders and the forensics pertaining to it, asking about Gabe's lead, which I finessed, and how the case was going and so forth. He also asked what was in the morning papers, and I informed him, "My photo." "Did they get your address right?" He laughed. Kate laughed. I said to Jack, "You owe me one on that." "Meaning?" "Meaning that me being a target is beyond the call of duty. So when I need a favor, you owe me one." He informed me, "You're so many points in the hole, Corey, you're now about even. It's a wash." Actually, I didn't think I was really a target, but I think Koenig thought so, which showed me a little of the FBI mindset. So I played on it and said, "Not a wash, not by my reckoning." "You guys know how to keep score, don't you?" By "you guys," he meant cops, of course. I said, "You owe me." "Okay. What do you want?" "How about the truth?" "I'm working on it." This seemed to be an admission and acknowledgement that there was more to this than we knew. I said, "Remember the motto of our CIA friends? And ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." "The truth can make you dead. You're very clever, Corey. And this is not a secure line." "Auf Wiedersehen," I said, and hung up. I went back to my incident report. So, in conclusion, Kate spoke to Jack a while longer and read the brief article about the murder of Mr. Leibowitz in Frankfurt. They chattered a while, then she hung up and said to me, "This is getting creepy." I looked up from my keyboard and said, "Reminds me of an X-Files episode where Scully's goldfish tried to kidnap her." Ms. Mayfield may have thought I was indirectly making fun of the FBI and didn't smile. We went back to our tasks. So, in conclusion, Phones were ringing all over the place, faxes were pinging, computer screens were glowing, telexes were doing whatever they do, clerks came around and plopped more stuff on people's desks, and so forth. This was truly the nerve center, the electronic brain of a far-flung operation. Unfortunately, the human brains in the room couldn't process all this fast enough or quickly separate the useless from the useful. I stood and said to Kate, "I'm going to find Gabe. Do you mind staying here so we don't miss Mrs. Hambrecht's call?" "Sure. What is it you were going to ask her?" "I'm not sure. Just put her in a good mood and have someone get me." "Okay." I left the ICC and went down to the interrogation rooms. I found Gabe talking to a few NYPD ATTF detectives in the corridor. He saw me, separated from the detectives, and came toward me. A steady stream of detectives were coming off the elevators or getting on, with Mideastern types in tow. He said, "You get my memo?" "Yeah, thanks." "Hey, I saw your picture in the papers." "So did every guy I've questioned today." I ignored this and said to Gabe, "There are so many Arabs here, we ought to order prayer rugs or get a sign pointing toward Mecca." "Done." "Anything new?" "Actually, yes. I called DC. The Metro cops, not the Bureau. I got to thinking that Mr. Khalil had no idea if he'd be brought to DC or to New York. So I inquired about any deceased or missing taxi drivers of Mideastern descent." "And?" "Got a missing person report. Guy named Dawood Faisal, taxi driver, Libyan. Went missing on Saturday." "Maybe he went to get his name changed." Gabe had learned to ignore me and continued, "I spoke to his wife, in Arabic, of course, and the wife said he went to Dulles for a fare and never came back. Sound a little familiar?" I thought this over. As Gabe was suggesting, this driver may have been recruited to pick up Khalil in the event Khalil wound up in D.C. At some point, Khalil's organization, whether it was Libyan intelligence or an extremist group, knew that their boy was going to New York. But Dawood Faisal knew too much already, and somewhere along the line they whacked him, or hopefully only kidnapped him for the duration of the mission. I said to Gabe, "Good thinking. What do we do with that information?" "Nothing. Another dead end. But it does suggest an elaborate and well-planned operation. There's no Libyan embassy in this country, but the Syrians have Libyans on staff in their embassy who are Gaddafi henchmen. All Arabs look alike, right? The CIA and FBI knows about this arrangement but allows it to continue. Gives them some Libyans to watch. But somebody wasn't watching Friday night when someone went to Faisal's house with a black bag. That's what Mrs. Faisal said. Same as with Mrs. Jabbar. Late Friday night visitor, black bag, husband looked worried. It all fits, but it's yesterday's news." "Yeah, but it does, as you say, suggest a well-planned operation with accomplices in this country. Also yesterday's news." "Right. Let me ask you something. As an Arab, can you put yourself into this guy's head? What is this asshole up to?" Gabe considered the politically incorrect question that suggested unfortunate racial stereotyping and replied, "Well, think about what he didn't do. He didn't sneak into this country anonymously. He got here at our expense, in more ways than one." "Right. Go on." "He's pushing camel shit in our faces. He enjoys that. But more than enjoying it, he's making a game of it. And he actually stacked the deck against himself, if you think about it." I thought about it, but why? "Well, it's an Arab thing." He smiled. "It's partly this feeling of inferiority regarding the West. The extremists plant bombs on planes and stuff like that, but they know this isn't very brave. So now and then you get a guy who wants to show the infidels how a brave mujahidi acts." "A mujah what?" "An Islamic freedom fighter. There's a long tradition of the lone Arab horseman, like in the American West, a mean and lean motherfucker, to use an Arab word, who rides alone and will take on an army. There's a famous poem. Terrible he rode alone, with his Yemen sword for aid. Ornament it carried none, but the notches on the blade." "Get it?" "I get it. So what's he up to?" I don't know. I'm just telling you who he is. Okay, but what's a guy like that usually up to? He's up to about 320 and still counting. Yeah. Okay, good work, Gabe. How's Fadi doing? Her name is now Maria, and she's a cleaning lady at St. Patrick's. He smiled. See you later. I turned to walk away, and Gabe said, Khalil's going for the big one. I turned around. Gabe said, if he showed up as a waiter at a presidential fundraiser, I wouldn't be surprised. He's got a lot of hate towards somebody who he thinks screwed him, or screwed Islam, or screwed Libya. He wants a personal confrontation. Go on. He thought a moment and said, the name of that poem is The Death Feud. I thought it was a love poem. It's a hate poem, my friend. It has to do with a blood feud, actually. Okay. An Arab can be motivated to great acts of bravery for God and sometimes for country, but rarely for something abstract like a political philosophy and hardly ever for a political leader. They often don't trust their leaders. I must be an Arab. But there's something else that really motivates an Arab, a personal vendetta. You know? Like the Sicilians. I know. Like, if you kill my son or my father, or fuck my daughter or my wife, I'll hunt you down to the ends of the earth if it takes me a lifetime, and I'll kill everyone you know or are related to until I get to you. I thought my wife's boss was fucking her. I sent him a case of champagne. Arabs don't think like that. Are you listening to me? I get it. This could be a blood feud, a vendetta. Right, could be. Also, Khalil doesn't care if he lives or dies trying to avenge the blood feud. It's only important that he tries. If he dies, he's still avenged, and he's going to paradise. I'll try to help him get there. Gabe said, if and when you two meet, the one who recognizes the other last is the one who's going to paradise. He laughed. I left. Why does everyone find it funny that my picture was in the papers? Back in the ICC, I got a fresh cup of coffee at the well-stocked coffee bar. There were croissants and brioche, muffins and cookies, but no donuts. Is this interagency cooperation? Anyway, I mulled over what Gabe had said. While mulling, Kate came over to the coffee bar and said, Mrs. Rose Hambrecht is on the telephone. I clarified who we are. I put down my coffee mug and hurried to my desk. I picked up the receiver and said, Mrs. Hambrecht, this is John Corey of the FBI Task Force. A cultured voice replied, What does this concern, Mr. Corey? Kate sat at her desk opposite me and picked up her telephone. I replied, First, my deepest condolences on the death of your husband. Thank you. I've been assigned to do some follow-up work regarding his death. Murder. Yes, ma'am. I'm sure you're tired of answering questions. I'll answer questions until his murderer is found. Thank you. You'd be surprised how many spouses don't give a rat's ass if the murderer of their departed honey bun is found, notwithstanding the surviving spouse's hidden desire to personally thank the culprit. But Mrs. H. seemed to be a grieving widow, so this might go well. I winged it and said, My records show that you've been questioned by the FBI, the Air Force CID, and Scotland Yard, correct? Correct. And by Air Force Intelligence, British MI5, MI6, and our CIA. I looked at Kate, and we made eye contact. I said, So that would seem to suggest that some people think there was a political motive for this murder. That's what I think. No one is telling me what they think. But your husband wasn't involved in politics or in intelligence work, according to his personnel file. That's correct. He was always a pilot, a commander, and recently a staff officer. I was trying to slide into the deleted information without spooking her, so I said contrarily, We're now starting to think this was a random murder. Your husband was targeted by an extremist group simply because he wore an American military uniform. Nonsense. I thought so too, so I asked her, Can you think of anything in his background that would make him a specific target of an extremist group? Silence. Then, well, it has been suggested that his involvement in the Gulf War may have made him a target of Muslim extremists. The captain of the Vincennes, do you know about that?
No, ma'am.
So she explained it to me, and I did recall the attempted assassination. I asked, so it's possible that this was revenge for his part in the Gulf War?
Yes, it's possible, but there were so many flyers involved in that war, thousands, and Bill was only a major then. So I never understood why he would be singled out.
But some people suggested to you that he was.
Yes, some people did.
But you are not sure of that.
No, I'm not.
She stayed silent a while, and I let her think about what she was sure of. Finally, she said,
then with the death of Terry and Gail Wycliffe, how could anyone still think my husband's death was random or connected to the Gulf War? Terry wasn't even in the Gulf.
I looked at Kate, who shrugged. I said, trying not to sound like I was clueless, you think the Wycliffe's deaths were related to your husband's death?
Perhaps.
If she thought so, then so did I. But she also thought I was informed, which I was not. I said, can you add anything to what we know about the Wycliffe's deaths?
Not much more than was in the papers.
Which story did you read?
Which story?
The Air Force Times. It was also reported in the Washington Post, of course. Why do you ask? I looked up at Kate, who was already on her computer banging away at the keyboard. I replied to Mrs. Hambrecht, some of the stories were inaccurate. How did you first hear of the deaths?
The Wycliffe daughter, Sue, called me yesterday.
She added, they were apparently killed sometime Sunday. I sat up in my chair.
Killed? As in murdered?
Kate's printer was spitting something out. I said to Mrs. Hambrecht, has anyone from the FBI or the Air Force spoken to you about this?
No, you're the first.
Kate was reading her printout and marking it. I motioned impatiently for her to hand it to me, but she kept reading it. I asked Mrs. Hambrecht, did their daughter indicate to you that she thought there was something suspicious about her parents' deaths?
Well, she was very distraught, as you can imagine. She said it appeared to be a robbery, but she sounded as though she wasn't sure.
She added, their housekeeper was also murdered. I was running out of generic questions, and finally Kate handed me the printout. I said to Mrs. Hambrecht, please hold. I put her on hold. Kate said, we may have hit on something. I quickly read the online news story from the Washington Post, discovering that Terrence Wycliffe was an Air Force general working in the Pentagon. Basically, it was reported as a straight homicide piece, saying that General and Mrs. Wycliffe and a housekeeper were found shot to death in the Wycliffe's Capitol Hill townhouse late Monday morning by the general's adjutant, who became concerned when his boss didn't report for work at his Pentagon office and didn't answer his telephone or pager. There was sign of forced entry. The door chain had been ripped from the jam, and it appeared that the motive was robbery. There were valuables and cash missing. The general was in uniform and had apparently just returned from church, setting the time of the robbery and murder at about Sunday morning. The police were investigating. I looked up at Kate and said, what is the link between General Wycliffe and Colonel Hambrecht?
I don't know. Find out.
Right. I got back on the line and said to Mrs. Hambrecht, sorry, that was the Pentagon.
Okay, Corey, give it a shot.
I decided to be blunt and truthful and see what happened. I said to her, Mrs. Hambrecht, let me be honest with you. I have your husband's personnel file in front of me. There is deleted information, and I'm having a difficult time accessing that information. I need to know what was deleted. I want to find out who killed your husband and why. Can you help me? There was a long silence, which I knew was not going to end. I said, please. I glanced up at Kate, who was nodding approvingly. Finally, Mrs. Rose Hambrecht said to me,
my husband along with General Wycliffe, participated in a military operation. A bombing mission. Why don't you know this? All of a sudden, I did know. What Gabe had said earlier was still in my head, and when Rose Hambrecht said bombing mission, it all came together like a key turning 15 lock tumblers and opening a door. I said, April 15, 1986. Yes. Do you see? Yes, I do. I looked at Kate, who was sort of staring into space, thinking hard. Mrs. Hambrecht further informed me there might even be a connection to that tragedy at Kennedy Airport on the anniversary date and what happened to the Wycliffes. I took a deep breath and replied, I'm not sure about that, but tell me, has anyone else who was on that mission met with a misfortune? There were dozens of men involved with that mission, and I can't account for all of them. I thought a moment, then said, but within your husband's unit? If you mean his squadron, there were, I think, 15 or 16 aircraft in his squadron. And do you know if any of those men have met with a misfortune that could be viewed as suspicious? I don't think so. I know that Stephen Cox was killed in the Gulf, but I'm not certain about the others. The men in my husband's flight on that mission kept in touch, but I don't know about the rest of the squadron. I was trying to remember Air Force terminology. Flights, divisions, squadrons, air wings, and all that, but I was up in the air, so to speak. I said, forgive my ignorance, but how many aircraft and men are in a flight and a squadron? It varies according to the mission, but generally there are 4 or 5 aircraft in a flight and perhaps 12 to 18 in a squadron. I see. And how many aircraft were in your husband's flight on April 15, 1986?
4.
And these men, 8 of them, correct?
Correct.
These men, I looked at Kate, who said into the telephone, Mrs. Hambrecht, this is Kate Mayfield again. I'm wondering, too, about this connection. Why don't you tell us what you think so we can get quickly to the heart of the matter? Mrs. Hambrecht said, I think I've said enough. I didn't think so, and neither did Kate. She said, Ma'am, we're trying to help solve your husband's murder. I know, as a military wife, that you're security conscious, and so are we. I assure you, this is one time you can speak freely. Would you like us to come to Ann Arbor and speak to you in person? There was another silence. Then Rose Hambrecht said, No. We waited through yet another silence. Then Mrs. Hambrecht said, All right. The 4 aircraft in my husband's flight of F-111s had the mission to bomb a military compound outside of Tripoli. It was called Al-Azizia. You may recall from the news at that time that one of the aircraft dropped a bomb on the home of Muammar Gaddafi. That was the Al-Azizia compound. Gaddafi escaped, but his adopted daughter was killed, and his wife and 2 sons were injured. I'm only telling you what has been reported. You can draw any conclusions you wish. I looked up at Kate, who was again banging away at her keyboard, looking at her video screen, and I hoped she could spell Al-Azizia and Muammar Gaddafi, or whatever she needed to get into this. I said to Mrs. Hambrecht, You may have come to some conclusions of your own. She replied, When my husband was murdered, I thought that perhaps it had something to do with his Libyan mission. But the Air Force positively assured me that all the names of those men involved with the bombing of Libya were top secret for all time and could never be accessed. I accepted this, but thought perhaps that some person involved with that mission had spoken too freely, or perhaps, I don't know. But I put it out of my mind. Until yesterday, when I learned that the Wycliffes had been murdered. It could be a coincidence. It could be, but it wasn't. I said, So of those 8 men who bombed, what's it called? Al-Azizia? One died in the Gulf War, and my husband was murdered, and so was Terry Wycliffe. I glanced again at Kate, who was printing out information. I asked Mrs. Hambrecht, Who were the other 5 men on that mission, the Al-Azizia mission? I may not and will not tell you, ever.
That was a pretty definite no, so there wasn't any point in pursuing it. I did ask, however, can you at least tell me if those five men are alive? They spoke on April 15th. Not all of them, but Terry called me afterwards and said everyone he spoke to was well and sent their regards, except one of them is very ill. Kate and I made eye contact. Kate said into the phone, Mrs. Hambrecht, can you give me a phone number where I can reach a member of the Wycliffe family? She replied, I suggest you call the Pentagon and ask for Terry's office. Someone there will be able to respond to your inquiries. Kate said, I'd rather speak to a family member. Then make that request through the Pentagon. Obviously, Mrs. Hambrecht had her protocols down pat and probably regretted this phone conversation. The military was, to say the least, clannish. But Mrs. Hambrecht apparently had some second thoughts on the subject of clan loyalty, and it had occurred to her that loyalty was supposed to be reciprocal. I had no doubt that the Air Force and other government agency had juked and jived her, and she knew it, or suspected it. Sensing that I'd come as far as I was going to get, I said to her, Thank you, ma'am, for your cooperation. Let me assure you that we're doing everything possible to bring your husband's killer to justice. She replied, I've already been assured of that. It's been almost 3 months since... I'm a softy sometimes, and I tend to stick my neck out in these situations, so I said, I think we're close to an answer. Again, I glanced at Kate and saw she was giving me a kind smile. Mrs. Hambrecht took a deep breath, which I could hear, and I thought she was starting to lose it. She said, I pray to God you're right. I miss him. I didn't reply, but I had to wonder who would miss me if I checked out. She got herself under control and said, They killed him with an axe. Yes. I'll keep in touch. Thank you. I hung up. Kate and I stayed silent a moment, then she said, That poor woman. Not to mention poor William Hambrecht being chopped up, but women have a different take on these things. I took a deep breath and quickly felt my tough guy self again. I said, Well, I guess we know what top secret stuff was deleted by executive order and DOD order. And it wasn't nuclear clearance, as someone told our esteemed boss. I left Kate to draw the conclusion that perhaps Jack Koenig was telling us less than he knew. Kate didn't or wouldn't get into that and said to me, You did a good job. You too. I asked her, What did you find online? She handed me some sheets of printout. I flipped through them, noting that they were mostly New York Times and Washington Post stories, dated after the April 15th, 1986 raid. I looked up at her and said, It's starting to make sense, isn't it? She nodded and said, It made sense from the beginning. We're not as smart as we think we are. Neither's anybody else around here. But solutions always look easy after you've come to them. Also, the Libyans aren't the only ones dragging red herrings around. She didn't comment on my paranoia. She did say, however, there are five men somewhere whose lives are in danger. I replied, It's now Tuesday. I doubt if all five men are still alive. Chapter 43 Asad Khalil woke from his short sleep and looked out the porthole of the Learjet. There was mostly blackness on the ground, but he noticed small clusters of lights and had the sense that the aircraft was descending. He looked at his watch, which was still on New York time, 3:16 a.m. If they were on schedule, they should be landing in Denver in 20 minutes. But he wasn't going to Denver. He picked up the airphone and with his credit card activated it and called a number he had committed to memory. After three rings, a woman's voice came on the line, sounding as if she'd been woken from a sleep, as well as she should have been at this hour. Hello? 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 Khalil hung up. If Mrs. Robert Callum, wife of Colonel Robert Callum, was asleep in her bed at her home in Colorado Springs, then Asad Khalil had to assume that the authorities were not in her home and not waiting for him. Boris and Malik had both assured him of this, The Americans would take his intended victims into protective custody if the authorities had set a trap for him. Khalil picked up the intercom handset and pressed the button. The co-pilot's voice came into the earpiece.
Yes, sir.
Khalil said, I have made a telephone call that will necessitate a change of plans. I must land at the airport in Colorado Springs.
No problem, Mr. Perlman. It's only about 75 miles south of Denver, about 10 minutes more flying time.
Khalil knew this, and Boris had assured him that mid-air changes in plans were not a problem. Boris had said, for the amount of money you're costing the Libyan treasury, they'll fly you in circles if you want.
The co-pilot said, I assume you want to land at the main municipal airport?
Yes.
I'll radio the necessary flight plan change, sir.
No problem.
Thank you.
Khalil put the receiver back on its hook. He stood, retrieved his black bag, and went into the small lavatory. After using the toilet, he removed the small travel kit from the overnight bag and shaved and brushed his teeth, keeping in mind all Boris's advice about American obsession with hygiene. He examined himself closely in the lighted mirror and discovered yet another bone splinter, this one in his hair. He washed his hands and face and again tried to rub out the specks on his tie and shirt, but Mr. Satherwaite, or part of him, seemed intent on accompanying him on this flight.
Khalil laughed. He found another tie in his black bag and changed ties.
Asad Khalil again went into the black bag and retrieved both Glock pistols. He ejected the magazines from each and replaced them with fully loaded magazines that he had taken from Hundry and Gorman. He chambered around in each Glock, took both of them off safety, and replaced them in the black bag. Khalil left the lavatory and put the bag in the aisle beside his seat. He then went to the console, which he noticed had a built-in tape and CD player, as well as a bar. He doubted if there was any music to his liking, and alcohol was forbidden. He found a can of orange juice in the small bar refrigerator and contemplated the food in a clear plastic container. He picked up a round piece of bread, which he suspected was the bagel that the captain had referred to. Boris had the foresight to brief him on bagels.
It is a Jewish creation, but all Americans eat them. During your journey, when you have become Jewish, be certain that you know what a bagel is. They can be sliced so that cheese or butter can be spread on them. They are kosher, so no pork lard is used in the baking, which will suit your religion as well.
Boris had added, in his offensive way,
pigs are cleaner than some of your countrymen I've seen in the souk.
Khalil's only regret about Boris's fate was that Malik had not given Khalil permission to personally kill the Russian before Khalil began his jihad. Malik had explained,
We need the Russian for mission control while you are away, and no, we will not save him for you. He will be eliminated as soon as we hear you are safely out of America. Ask nothing further about this matter.
It had occurred to Khalil that Boris might be spared because he was valuable, but Malik had assured him that the Russian knew too much and must be silenced. Yet Khalil wondered why he, Asad Khalil, who had suffered the insults of this infidel, wasn't given the pleasure of cutting Boris's throat. Khalil put this out of his mind and returned to his seat. He ate the bagel, which tasted vaguely like unleavened pita, and drank his orange juice, which tasted of the metal can. His limited encounters with American food had convinced him that Americans had little sense of taste or had great tolerance for bad taste. Khalil felt the aircraft descending more rapidly now and noticed that it was banking to the left. He looked out his window and saw, in the far distance, a great expanse of light which he assumed to be the city of Denver. Beyond the city, clearly visible in the moonlight, was a wall of towering white-capped mountains rising toward the sky. The aircraft made more maneuvers, then the intercom crackled. The voice of the co-pilot came into the cabin.
Mr. Perlman, we're beginning our descent into Colorado Springs Municipal Airport. Please fasten your seatbelt in preparation for landing. Please acknowledge.
Khalil picked up the handset mounted on the bulkhead, pressed the button, and said, I understand.
Thank you, sir. We'll be on the ground within 5 minutes. Clear skies, temperature 6 degrees Celsius.
Khalil fastened his seatbelt. He heard the landing gear being lowered and locked into place.
The small jet was very low now, flying straight and level, and within a few minutes they crossed over the runway threshold, and within seconds, the aircraft touched down on a long, wide runway. The co-pilot said over the intercom, "Welcome to Colorado Springs." Khalil had the irrational urge to tell the co-pilot to shut up. Asad Khalil did not want to be in Colorado Springs. He wanted to be in Tripoli. He did not want to be welcomed anywhere in this godless country. He wanted only to kill who had to be killed and to go home. The aircraft turned onto a taxiway, and the co-pilot slid back the partition and looked into the cabin. "Good morning." Khalil did not reply. The co-pilot said, "We'll taxi to the parking area and let you out before we refuel. Do you know how long you'll need here, sir?" "Unfortunately, I do not. It may be as little as 2 hours, perhaps less. On the other hand, the meeting may go well. Then there are contracts to be signed and probably breakfast, so I may return here about 9 o'clock, but no later." "Fine, we're on your schedule." The co-pilot added, "We're at the corporate jet facility, sir. Is your party meeting you here?" "I'm afraid not. I am to meet them at the main terminal, then proceed elsewhere. I will need transportation to the terminal. I'll see what I can do. Should be no problem." The Learjet taxied toward a row of large hangars. Khalil unbuckled his seatbelt and reached into his bag, keeping an eye on the pilots. He removed both Glocks and stuck them in his waistband behind each hip so his suit jacket would cover them. He stood, took his bag, and walked toward the pilots. He bent at the knees so he could see through the windshield and side windows of the cockpit. The captain said, "You might be more comfortable in your seat, sir." "I wish to stay here." "Yes, sir." Khalil scanned the tarmac and the hangars. As in the Long Island airport, he saw nothing to cause him alarm. Also, the appearance of the pilots seemed normal. The Learjet slowed and stopped on the parking ramp. A man and a woman in overalls appeared, but again, Khalil did not sense any danger. But even if they were waiting for him, he would send some of them to hell before he ascended into paradise. He recalled that Malik had arrived one day at the training school with a mursid, a spiritual guide, who had said to Khalil, "If even the smallest portion of your jihad is completed, you are assured a place in paradise. God does not judge as men judge, but he judges what he sees in your heart, where men cannot see. As revealed in the Holy Scripture, if you should die or be slain in the cause of Allah, his forgiveness and his mercy will surely be better than all the riches the infidels amass." The mursid further assured him, "God does not count the number of enemies you slay for him. God counts only the enemies you swear with all your heart to slay." Malik had thanked the mursid, and after the holy man had gone, Malik had clarified the man's guidance by saying, "God is more pleased when good intentions become great success. Try to kill all of them without getting yourself killed." As Khalil stared out the cockpit windows, he thought he could do just that. He felt close to complete success in the worldly sense. In the spiritual sense, he already felt complete fulfillment. The pilot shut down the engines and said, "We can deplane now, sir." Khalil stood and moved back into the cabin as the co-pilot got out of his seat and went to the exit door, which he opened, causing a step to extend. The co-pilot exited the aircraft and held out his hand for Khalil. Asad Khalil ignored the outstretched hand and stood in the doorway of the aircraft, searching the landscape before him. The facility was illuminated by large overhead lights, and there seemed to be few people around at this hour, which was not quite 2 a.m. local time. As he stood in the doorway, the pilot remained in his seat, and Khalil knew he could escape if he had to. He thought back to his training in Libya. He had been assured in Tripoli that the Americans had a standard operating procedure and would not use a sniper to kill him, unless he was barricaded and firing at them, and then only if he had no hostages. Also, they would be sure he was alone, in the open, before they would surround him with armed men, and even women, who would shout at him to raise his hands and surrender. These people would have bulletproof vests, as he himself had, and he understood that only a headshot would kill them or him. He had practiced this situation in the camp outside of Tripoli, using men, but not women, dressed as police, or in suits, or some in paramilitary clothing. They all spoke a few words of English, and they would shout, "Freeze!
Freeze! Hands up! Hands up! Get on the ground! Lay down! Lay down!
He had been instructed to feign great fear and confusion. He would kneel instead of lying down, and they would draw closer, still shouting, as was their method. Then, as they drew into range, he would draw both pistols from his waistband and begin shooting. The 40-caliber Glock would not pierce body armor, but unlike the older 9mm, it would knock a man down and stun him. To assure him of this, his trainers had demonstrated on a condemned prisoner. At 20 meters, they had fired a 40-caliber round from the Glock at the prisoner's chest, and the man, wearing a Kevlar vest, was knocked off his feet and lay stunned for a half minute, until he got up and was knocked down again by another round. They did this two more times until the prisoner would not or could not get up again. A bullet to his head ended the demonstration. Boris had told him, "Do not expect to win a gun battle. Americans pride themselves on good marksmanship. Guns are an important part of their culture, and the ownership of guns is actually guaranteed in their constitution." Khalil found this difficult to believe. Boris often invented things about the Americans, probably to impress and shock everyone. In any case, they had practiced what Boris called the shootout many times, and Boris had concluded, "It is possible to escape from a shootout. It has been done. If you are not badly wounded, you simply run, my friend, like a lion, faster and further than they can run. They have been trained not to shoot when they run. They may hit an innocent person or each other. They may shoot and not run, or run and not shoot. In either case, put some distance between you and them, and you may very well escape." Khalil recalled asking, "And what if they have a man with a sniper rifle?" "Then," Boris replied, "expect to have your legs shot out from under you. They hesitate to kill with a sniper rifle and pride themselves on bringing down a man without killing him." He added, "At that point, be sure you have a round left for yourself. You shouldn't miss your head at such close range." Boris had laughed, but said in a soft voice, "I wouldn't kill myself if I were you. Fuck Malik." Asad Khalil noticed now that the co-pilot was still standing at the foot of the steps, attempting to keep a smile on his face while he waited patiently for his passenger. The pilot had gotten out of his seat and was also waiting for Khalil to step out. Khalil gripped his black bag with his left hand and kept his right hand free to draw his pistol. He stepped down onto the tarmac and stood close to the co-pilot. The pilot followed and walked toward a man whose windbreaker said, "Ramp agent." Khalil stayed close to the co-pilot, closer than the suggested 1 meter, but the co-pilot made no move to distance himself from his passenger. Khalil kept scanning the tarmac, the vehicles, the hangars, and the parked aircraft. The pilot walked back to Khalil and said, "That gentleman will take you to the main terminal in his own car." The pilot added in a softer voice, "You may want to give him a tip, sir." "How much?" "10 should do it." Khalil was glad he'd asked. In Libya, $10 would buy a man for 2 days. Here, it would buy a 10-minute favor. Khalil said to the pilots, "Thank you, gentlemen. If I don't return in approximately 2 hours, then you can expect me, as I said, about 9 o'clock. No later." Captain Fisk replied, "Understood. Please look for us in that building where there's a pilot's lounge." Khalil joined the ramp agent, and after a few words of introduction, they walked to a parking lot and got into the ramp agent's automobile. Khalil sat in the front, beside the agent, though in Tripoli he would take the honored position in the rear. The Americans, Boris kept reminding him, were very democratic on the surface. "In my former classless workers' state," Boris said, "everyone knew their place and stayed there. In America, the classes pretend to mix with each other. No one is happy with this, but when the occasions arise, the Americans become great egalitarians. However, they spend a good deal of time avoiding those occasions." The ramp agent started his car and pulled out of the lot. He said to Khalil, "First time in Colorado Springs, Mr. Perlman?"
"Yes."
"Where are you from?"
"Israel."
"No kidding. I was there once. You live there?"
"Yes."
They followed a barrier road toward the municipal terminal. Too bad you can't stay around. This is a great place. Skiing, hiking, boating, horseback riding, hunting. Well, hunting's kind of unpopular these days.
Why?
People are down on guns, on killing.
Really?
Some people. It's a big issue. You hunt?
I'm afraid not. I don't like the sight of blood.
Well, then, I'll keep my mouth shut. They continued toward the terminal. The ramp agent, forgetting his promise, said, "Lots of military around here. The north side of this airfield is Peterson Air Force Base, and just south of here is Fort Carson. Army. Also, as you probably know, this is the home of the United States Air Force Academy. And in the mountains there to the left is NORAD, North American Air Defense Command, built right into Cheyenne Mountain. There's 1,000 people who work deep inside that expensive hole. Yeah, lots of military around here. Real conservative. Now, north of Denver, you got Boulder. Real liberal. The People's Republic of Boulder." He laughed, then continued, "Like I said, I was in Israel. My wife's real religious, and she dragged me to Jerusalem once. I don't mean dragged. A great city. We saw all the religious sites, you know? Hey, you're Jewish, right?"
"Of course."
"Sure. We took this tour, you know, to the Dome of the Rock. It's an Arab mosque, but it turns out that this was the main Jewish temple once. Well, I guess you know that. I mean, Christ probably went there. He was Jewish. Now, it's a mosque." He looked at his passenger and said, "I think the Jews should take it back. That's what I think. They had it first. Then these Arabs come along and grab it and build a mosque there. Why should the Arabs own it?"
"Because Muhammad ascended into heaven from that rock. Peace be unto him."
"Huh?" Khalil cleared his throat and said, "This is what the Muslims believe."
"Oh."
"Yeah. Well, the guide said that."
"Hey, I shouldn't talk religion."
Khalil did not reply. They pulled up to the front of the municipal terminal. Khalil opened his door and started to leave, then leaned back and gave the ramp agent a $10 bill.
"Thank you."
"Thank you. See you later." Khalil got out of the automobile and it pulled away. He saw that the terminal area was nearly deserted at this hour, but noted a taxi stand where two yellow vehicles sat parked. He walked into the terminal, aware that a man alone at this hour would attract attention if anyone were there to notice. But he didn't even see a policeman. A man pushed a large broom over the tile floor but did not look at him. They had stressed to him in Tripoli that municipal airports had much less security than international airports, and that even if the authorities were looking for him in America, the risks at these smaller airports would be minimal. Khalil strode quickly and purposely through the main lobby, remembering from photos and diagrams where the business center and conference rooms were. In an area just off the lobby, he saw a door marked Conference Room 2. Another sign said, "Reserved." There was a keypad, and he punched in a code and opened the door. He entered the room and closed the door behind him. The room was equipped with a conference table, 8 chairs, telephones, a fax machine, and a computer console. A coffee machine sat in a small alcove. The computer screen had a message, and he read, "Welcome, Mr. Perlman. Have a successful meeting. Your friends at Neely Conference Center Associates." Khalil didn't recall any such friends. He put his bag on the floor and sat at the keyboard of the computer. He erased the message, then clicked the mouse until he got to his email screen. He typed in his password and waited for the modem to access his account. He then read the one incoming message, which appeared on the screen in English, addressed to Perlman from Jerusalem. "We have reports that business is good with you. Saul's trip to Frankfurt has been terminated. Rival American firm in Frankfurt looking into this. No word here of rival American firm knowledge of your itinerary. Business in Colorado not necessary. Use judgment. California more important. Arrangements for return to Israel remain unchanged. Much success. See you soon. Reply requested. Mazel Tov." It was signed, Mordecai. Khalil switched screens to send his response. He typed slowly, "Reply your message in Colorado. Business, good. California business, soon." Khalil tried to fashion more English sentences, but it was not important that he do so. They had told him in Tripoli that any message would do as long as it contained the word business, which meant he was well and not under the control of the Americans. He signed it Perlman, then sent his email. He got out of his email account, returned to the main screen, and shut off the computer. He looked at his watch and saw it was 4:17 a.m. New York time, 2 hours earlier here. The home of Colonel Robert Callum was in the foothills of the mountain range, less than half an hour from where he now sat. There was an all-night car rental agency less than 10 minutes from the airport by taxi, and there was a car reserved for Samuel Perlman there. Khalil stood and paced the room. Business in Colorado, not necessary. California, more important. But why couldn't he do both? He thought about going back through the terminal, taking a taxi to the car rental agency, renting the car, then driving to the home of Colonel Callum. There was some risk involved. There was always risk involved. But for the first time since he had walked into the American Embassy in Paris, Asad Khalil had a sense of, not danger, he thought, but urgency. He continued pacing, weighing all the arguments for and against killing Colonel Callum and, of course, his wife and whoever else would be in the house. The plan was simple, just as it had been at General Wycliffe's house. He would wait here, where it was safe, then go to the car rental agency, then drive to the colonel's rural home in the early morning. The colonel or his wife exited the house each morning no later than 7:30 and retrieved a newspaper from the mailbox at the end of the driveway, then re-entered the house. Like most military people, the Callums were punctual and habitual. Once the door was open, the Callums were only 5 or 10 minutes away from death, their remaining lifespan depending entirely upon Asad Khalil's mood and patience. He continued to pace the small room. Like a lion, he thought, a lion such as the Romans kept in the arena at Leptis Magna, whose ruins he had seen near Tripoli. The lion knows from past experience that a man awaits him in the arena, and the lion becomes impatient. Surely he is hungry. The lion must be kept hungry. The lion also knows from his past experience that he always kills the man. What other experience could he know if he is still alive? But he also knows that he has encountered two kinds of men in the arena, the armed and the unarmed. The armed fought for their lives. The unarmed prayed. They tasted equally well. Khalil stopped pacing. He squatted on the floor, balancing himself on his haunches as the Berber tribesmen did in the desert. He raised his head and closed his eyes but did not pray. Instead, he transported himself into the night desert and imagined a million brilliant stars in the black sky. He saw the full bright moon hanging over Kufra, his native oasis, and saw the palms swaying in the cool desert breeze. The desert was, as always, quiet. He remained in the desert for a very long time, keeping the image unchanged, waiting for an unbidden image to appear out of the desert sands. Time passed on earth but stood still on the desert. Finally, a messenger came out from the oasis, draped in cloths of black and white, illuminated by the moonlight, casting a shadow on the sands as the figure moved toward him. The messenger stood before him but did not speak, and Asad Khalil dared not speak. Khalil could not see the messenger's face but heard now a voice. The voice said, "In the place where you are now, God will do your work for you. Go from that place to the other place across the mountains. The sands of time are running out. Satan is stirring." Asad Khalil murmured a prayer of thanks, opened his eyes, and stood. He focused on the wall clock across the room and saw that over 2 hours had passed, though it seemed only minutes. He gathered his black bag, left the room, and moved quickly through the deserted lobby. Outside, he saw a solitary taxi occupied by a sleeping driver. He got into the rear of the taxi and slammed the door hard. The taxi driver awoke with a start and mumbled some confused words. Khalil said, "To the corporate jet facility, quickly." The driver started the engine, threw the vehicle into gear, and pulled away. "Where?" Khalil repeated his destination and threw a $20 bill on the front seat beside the driver. Quickly, please. I am late. The driver sped up and got onto the barrier road. Within 10 minutes, he was at the corporate jet facility. Khalil said, Over there. The driver pulled up to a small building, and Khalil jumped out and walked rapidly into the building. He located the pilot's lounge where he found both men asleep on couches. He shook the captain and said, I am ready. We must leave soon. Captain Fisk rose quickly to his feet. The co-pilot was already awake, and he stood, stretched, and yawned. Khalil looked pointedly at his watch and said, How long will it take to leave here? Captain Fisk cleared his throat and said, Well, I've already made preliminary arrangements for our outboard flight plan, in the event we needed to depart suddenly. Yes, good. We need to depart suddenly. When can we depart? Well, at this early hour, there's not much other air traffic, so we can take a few shortcuts with standard procedure. With luck, we should be able to taxi out in 15 minutes. As soon as possible. Yes, sir. Captain Fisk walked over to a telephone and punched in a few numbers. Who are you calling? Control tower to activate my prior arrangements. Captain Fisk spoke to someone on the other end. Khalil listened carefully to what the pilot said, but it seemed to be nothing more than technical talk. He looked at the pilot's face, then at the co-pilot, and both men seemed composed. Captain Fisk said into the phone, Okay, thanks. He hung up and said to his passenger, They promised to have our air traffic control departure clearance within 15 minutes. The local tower is already coordinating it with Denver radar. I was under the impression that private flights could take off and land at their convenience. Captain Fisk replied, That's not true for private jets, sir, because of the altitudes at which we fly. Above 18,000 feet, instrument flight rules always apply. I see. Can we go now to the aircraft? Sure. Fisk led the way out of the lounge, followed by the co-pilot and Asad Khalil. They walked quickly through the cold night air toward the Learjet less than 50 meters away. Khalil stayed very close to his pilots, but he had the sense that there was no immediate danger. The co-pilot opened the door of the Lear and entered, followed by Khalil, then by the captain. The pilots took their seats and began their pre-flight checks as Khalil took his seat in the rear of the cabin. Captain Fisk called back through the open partition, We'll be underway shortly. Please fasten your seatbelt. Khalil did not reply. A few minutes later, Fisk started both engines and the co-pilot radioed, Springs Tower, Lear 2-5 Echo is ready to taxi. The tower replied, Roger, Lear 2-5 Echo, taxi to runway 3-5 left. I've got your clearance when you're ready. Go ahead with the clearance. Co-pilot said into the microphone, then began writing down what was being said on a pad in his lap. Captain Fisk continued to taxi the Lear 60 to the end of runway 35L, then wheeled the jet onto the runway centerline. Here we go, Fisk said to no one in particular as he pushed the twin throttles forward. Within half a minute, the jet nosed up, left the ground, and was climbing away rapidly from the lights of Colorado Springs below. Khalil watched the pilots who had not yet slid closed the partition door between the cockpit and cabin. After a minute, he glanced out the side window to his left and watched the mountains in the distance, which were still visible in the moonlight. The co-pilot got on the intercom and said, We need to continue on this northbound heading for a little while longer, sir, to get some altitude before we can turn westbound and on course. We've got those little hills over there to our left called the Rockies. He laughed and added, Some of those peaks are 12,000 feet, about 4,000 meters. Khalil did not reply, but he looked at the foothills and mountains to their left as they continued on what was evidently a northerly heading. Somewhere down there, Colonel Robert Callum lay in bed, a terrible disease eating away at him. Khalil did not feel cheated, nor had he felt cheated when he'd learned that Stephen Cox had died in the war against Iraq. God, he decided, wished to claim his share of the spoils of war. Chapter 44. Kate and I spent the rest of the morning ringing the alarm bell, so to speak. The incident command center went from anthill to beehive, if you'll pardon the insect analogy. Kate and I fielded about a dozen calls from higher-ups, congratulating us and so forth. Also, all the bosses wanted a private briefing from us, but we managed to put them off. They really didn't want any information. They wanted to say they were part of the solution, though, of course, they were becoming part of the problem. Finally, I had to agree to a joint task force meeting such as we'd had yesterday morning. But I was able to put it off until 5 p.m. by lying about having to stay at the phones for calls from my worldwide network of informants. In some respects, the bosses here resembled the NYPD brass when a big case was making the news. Photo ops with me and Kate couldn't be far off. In any case, by the time Jack Koenig returned from collecting frequent flyer miles, the meeting would be over and Jack would be pissed. Tough. I told him to stay here. Within a half hour of our conversation with Mrs. Hambrecht, FBI agents were subpoenaing the phone records of Mrs. Hambrecht and, of course, General Wycliffe for April 15th. At the same time, the good people in the J. Edgar Hoover building were pushing hard to get the deleted information from Colonel Hambrecht's file, which I really didn't need now. But they were also trying to find the names of the surviving men in his flight who bombed Al-Azizia, which we did need. According to my email, the FBI had immediately warned the Air Force and DOD that the men on the Al-Azizia mission were in great and immediate danger, and that some degree of danger also existed for all the other men who flew the Libyan mission. The Air Force agreed to cooperate fully and quickly, of course, but in any bureaucracy, quickly is a relative term. I didn't know if the CIA was being kept informed, but I hoped they were not. I still had this weird idea that the CIA knew some of this already. Okay, it's easy to get totally paranoid about those people, and half the time, as I keep reminding myself, they're not as smart or cunning as people think. But as with any secret organization, they themselves sowed the seeds of mistrust and deception. Then they wonder why everybody thinks they're hiding something. What they're usually hiding is the fact that they don't know much. Sometimes I do the same thing, so how could I complain? I never actually thought that the FBI, which is the heart of the anti-terrorist task force, knew more than they were telling us in New York. But I was convinced they knew, as Kate said, that the CIA was in business for itself. And they let it pass because, after all, we're all on the same team, and we're all on the same side of the angels, and everybody has the best interests of the country at heart. The only problem was in defining best interests. The good news was that Koenig and Nash were out of the country. Anyway, during a little lull in the beehive activity, I looked at the printouts that Kate was still running from cyberspace. I started with a New York Times story dated March 11, 1989, headlined, "Blast Wrecks Van of Skipper Who Downed Iran Jet." This was about the Vincennes captain and didn't seem pertinent except as an example of what we suspected was happening now. Kate handed me an Associated Press article dated April 16, 1996, headlined, "Libya Seeks Trials Over 1986 Air Raids." I read aloud, "Libya demanded Monday that the United States surrender the pilots and planners behind air raids on Libyan cities 10 years ago, and Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi insisted the United Nations take up the case." I looked at Kate and said, "I guess we didn't hand anyone over," and Gaddafi got impatient. "Read on," she said. I continued, "We can't forget what happened," Gaddafi said, "on the anniversary of the U.S. attacks, which Libya said wounded over 100 people and killed 37, including Gaddafi's adopted daughter. These children, are they animals and Americans or human beings?" asked Gaddafi in a CNN interview in the ruins of his bombed-out home, left standing a full decade after the raids. I looked up at Kate. She said, "I'm guessing that Asad Khalil lived in this military compound with the Gaddafi family. Remember, there was a family connection according to our files." "Right." I thought about this and said, "Khalil would have been about 15 or 16 when the raid occurred. His father was already dead, but he must have had friends and family at this compound." Kate nodded. "He's avenging them and the Gaddafi family." "Makes sense to me." I thought again about what Gabe had said earlier. I said to Kate, "Now we know what's motivating this guy, and I have to tell you, I mean, I don't sympathize with the bastard, but I understand." She nodded. "I know." She added, "Khalil is more dangerous than we thought, if that's possible." Read on. I read the end of the AP story. Gaddafi spoke as Libya conducts ceremonies in remembrance of the U.S. raids on the Libyan capital, Tripoli, and on Benghazi. The raids were in retaliation for the bombing of the LaBelle discotheque in Berlin on April 5, 1986, which killed one U.S. serviceman. Libya's demands mirror U.S. insistence that Libya turn over to America or British courts two men wanted for the 1988 bombing of Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie, Scotland, which killed 270 people. I put the article aside and said, "Round and round it goes, where it stops, nobody knows." Indeed, a war without end. This is just another battle brought about by the last battle, which will lead to the next battle. That's a depressing thought. I scanned a few more articles and came across later articles about the captain of the Vincennes incident. As I said, there was no direct connection with Khalil, but I noticed an interesting progression of headlines, one of which from the New York Times read, "Bombing Inquiry Moving from State Terror Theory." The first of the succeeding articles indicated that maybe the Iranian government wasn't involved after all, and maybe no extremist groups were involved. Maybe it was a lone political weirdo, or maybe it was just a coincidence, or a personal grudge, leaving one wondering about who the captain or his wife pissed off down at the officers' club. Bullshit. It was incredible how Washington spun these stories to calm people down and not get everyone worked up about Iranians, or Iraqis, or Libyans, or other countries who really didn't like us and who got their own people worked up over the slightest incidents. There must be some sort of great diplomatic strategy at work, but I didn't get it. By this time next month, Asad Khalil would be described as a lone malcontent, angry at the U.S. for smearing ink on his entry visa. If you don't think anyone knows what they're doing in the White House or the J. Edgar Hoover building or the Pentagon or Langley, try the State Department. They're totally adrift with one oar in the water. Anyway, geopolitics aside, Asad Khalil was either done and gone or heading toward his next victim. I said to Kate, "Any word on the crews of that mission?" "No, but they won't necessarily tell us. By now, the FBI could have the survivors covered." "I think they should tell us. In the NYPD, the investigating detective knows and is responsible for everything." "I hate to be the bearer of bad news, John, but this is not the NYPD, and you'll be lucky if you even get a phone call telling you Khalil has been arrested." This really sucked. I racked my brain for ways to get a piece of the action, but all I could think of was that Jack Koenig owed me a favor, though we disagreed on that obvious and simple fact. But Koenig wasn't around, and I had no pull or influence here, and no one else owed me anything. I asked Kate, "Have you slept with a supervisor who could do us a favor?" "Not in New York." "Washington?" She seemed to be thinking about this, counting on her fingers and murmuring numbers until she reached 7, then said, "I think I called in all those favors." She laughed to show me she was just kidding. Anyway, I flipped through a few more news articles that had arrived from another dimension. I'm not real sure how the internet works, but it seems to tell you what you ask for, and it does what it's told, which is more than I can say for a lot of people I know. I came across an article from the Boston Globe that was informative. It was dated April 20th, 1986. It was a chronology of the events that led up to the American air attack. The first date of the crises was January 7th. It said, "President Reagan accuses Libya of armed aggression against the United States and orders economic sanctions against Libya and orders all Americans out of that country. Western allies refuse to join the boycott. United States links Libya to an attack by Palestinian terrorists, December 27, 1985, on Rome and Vienna airports, which killed 20 people. I continued reading. January 11, senior aide to Colonel Muammar Gaddafi says Libya will attempt to assassinate Reagan if United States attacks it. Gaddafi invites Reagan to visit him, saying a meeting might change Reagan's attitude. I wouldn't have bet the rent money on that. I scanned the chronology and saw a definite pattern of two strong-willed macho males engaged in a pissing contest. January 13th, two Libyan jet fighters approach a U.S. Navy surveillance plane. February 5th, Libya accuses U.S. of helping Israelis locate and bring down a Libyan plane, vows revenge. March 24th, U.S. warplanes strike a Libyan missile site. March 25th, U.S. forces hit 4 Libyan patrol boats. March 28th, Gaddafi warns that military bases in Italy and Spain or any country aiding U.S. 6th Fleet would be targets for retaliation. April 2nd, bomb explodes on TWA flight en route from Rome to Athens, killing 4 persons. Palestinian group says it was in retaliation for U.S. attacks on Libya. April 5th, bomb explodes in West Berlin disco, killing 1 U.S. serviceman. April 7th, U.S. ambassador to West Germany says U.S. has very clear evidence of Libyan involvement in disco bombing. I look down at the page at the rest of the events that led up to April 15th, 1986. No one could say they were surprised by the bombing raid, given the personalities involved, and as we would say today in a gentler America, the misunderstandings brought about by unfortunate cultural and political stereotyping. The answer to the problem might well be in more immigration. At the rate we were going, most of the Middle East would be in Brooklyn within 5 years. I picked up the last piece of cyber news on my desk and scanned it. I said to Kate, "Hey, this is interesting. Did you see this April 1986 Associated Press interview with Mrs. Gaddafi?" "Don't think so." I read, "The wife of Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi, who said her adopted daughter, Hannah, 18 months old, had been killed in the raid, spoke to reporters for the first time since the attack. Seated in front of her